Send in the films in honor of Joker and Wrinkles the Clown documentary coming out in the same week. What genre of movie needs a clown?
I'm Kitty Rich, and I'm imagining a rom-com in which, like, Jenny Slate plays someone whose job is to be a clown by day and then meet somebody nice. It's possible this movie already exists, but if not, make it.
Definitely premieres at Sundance. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with the important genre of sullen French animation. Give me The Illusionist, but make it clowns.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm saying Muppets, but the clown is a Muppet that knows he's a Muppet, is a person, is a clown.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with none of them. No movies need clowns. The world doesn't need clowns. I'm anti-clown. I'm coming out as anti-clown.
Wow. What did clowns do to you? Age.
I just don't get them. Freaked me out as a kid. Somebody, I avoided both It movies very deliberately.
What do you have against Bill Irwin?
My neighbors, on September 30th, which is the day that we are recording this episode, put up an elaborate It display on their front lawn with It the Clown or whatever the fuck his name is hiding behind a well. Oh, my God.
I'm laughing at your suffering, but it's very funny.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting It in the War Room. It is episode 274.5, and it's the week of Wednesday, October 5th. Nope, October 2nd. It's the week of Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. That is the day that in 1950, the first Lil' Folks starring Charlie Brown, the newspaper comic strip by Charles Schulz, was published.
It became Peanuts later.
It did. And I did not name my child Charlie after him, but obviously not a bad pop culture touchstone to share your name with.
Did you see that meme going around?
Folks?
Did I see what? What?
There's a meme. There's a meme going around about pop culture names that ruined your name.
I did. I don't really have one. Do you guys have one? What's like a pop culture?
Davy Crockett.
David. Did anyone ever call you Davy though?
No. But
David Crockett.
Okay.
Oh, you're talking to the
David
other one.
Davy Crockett. This is elementary school, and then obviously Speedy Gonzalez. But it didn't stick because I'm not fast.
That's too bad.
You all have really boring names.
I don't know. I was always kind of into it when my name came up in pop culture. I was really responded to Dave, the Kevin Klein movie.
What about David, the boy robot in AI?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh,
Is it Harvey Fierstein is yelling the name David?
David!
Independence Day.
Independence Day.
There you go.
David!
Yeah, there's not too many bad Katies out there.
Call my lawyer!
To other Katie Rich, who got briefly suspended from SNL. That was
cool. Oh, yeah.
But,
other Katie Rich.
Solidarity with the other Katie Rich. Anyway.
My wife just opened the door looking like... responding to my Harvey Fierstein impression.
You screaming your own name.
It seemed very concerned.
I might also be concerned. Okay. David! Do we have any reviews?
We do. We have two reviews. The first from the Master Puppin. The Master Puppin says, "Wish David would watch Succession." I'm going to stop you right there, the Master Puppin, and tell you it's not going to happen.
I feel like this week's episode more insufferable is not going to
me. Richard muted Succession on Twitter. He tweeted Richard Lawson of Vanity Fair tweeted that, and I was like, "What a smart man!" I should do that. That show is fucking insufferable. And every, and
but
like,
you haven't even watched
people,
it. How do you know?
No, just like on the periphery and the way that people talk about it. But then I overhear snatches of it. Elisa watches it. I just overheard a couple minutes and it's just like confirmed all of my worst feelings about it. One day.
Why is it insufferable?
I will go back. It's just like people seem very excited with television shows where people call each other names that you can't say on basic cable. And that I'm sure the show is much richer than that. But I don't know, the way that people talk about it, it just feels very much not for me. It just feels like it's all affect and surface and not really,
I mean, imagine being on the outside of your film festival tweets. It's the same thing.
When you're on paternity leave, I look forward to watching Succession.
Come on, that was a solid diss. Give me some credit.
No, it wasn't. It was a terrible
meet. I zinged you. I zinged. I should be on Succession.
Anyway, I'm not going to be watching Succession anytime soon. I would sooner watch all of Parenthood on my paternity leave, which feels
that's what I did on my paternity leave. It was fine. It was not a great use of time.
I will consider watching Succession if it continues at its current rate of belovedness and then is canceled at some point in the future. With the confidence that it stays at whatever people perceive to be its level of quality, I will watch it. But it really has also like the stink of Vice on it. The Adam McKay brand is really tainted for
the
it.
Adam, so I'm in DK, no hurry.
And I watched the first episode and it was horrendous. So I know it gets better, or so people say. Anyway, it's not happening, the Master Puppin, but what is happening is me reading the rest of your review. Great freaking podcast. Love the chemistry between the hosts and the fighting is wonderful. The Puppins from Iceland send David their best wishes and recommend that he checks out Succession, as he will love it. We see a deep connection between him and poor old Kendall. I feel like that's a diss. thank you, Dave, for sending Hobo Johnson our way. We feel his pain and we can relate. Keep up the good work, you guys. You swing. Was this review helpful? I don't know.
It was to me.
I'll say yes. I don't know if I needed to like rehash my similarly uninformed opinion on Succession, which has not gotten any more dimensionalized since the last time I aired my
grievances.
Don't
you like being reminded of Iceland?
Yes. Oh, that was very helpful. That does bring my blood pressure down a little bit. Although I feel like, is Puffins, I think they were like Pufflets? Wait, baby Puffins.
Pufflings?
Are called Pufflings. Pufflings.
I know that from a Puffling. Netflix children's show about Puffins.
Oh, Pufflings. Now I'm just looking at pictures of Pufflings.
They're really cute.
So wait, what's a puppin?
A puffin is a bird.
No, native. A puppin. You were saying puppin.
No, this guy
a young
wrote
puppin.
Puppin. I think that's a misnomer.
But they're called pufflings.
Yeah. A puppin, Urban Dictionary says a puppin is a young cat, is a kitty or kitten, thus a young dog is a puppy or a puppin. But puffling is the even cuter name. It's a puffin. David Readme says, oh no, sorry. What is hot may never pie! ! Says David Readme. Hi guys, Paul from Denver here. Shout out Dave Seven. I was drawn to this podcast by discovering that David Ehrlich was on it. David the Insufferable, and then he has spelled out the word with a period between each letter, as like the notorious B.I.G. The Insufferable P.R.I.C.K. The needlessly contrarian, the hopelessly smug Letterboxd user whose reviews always managed to float to the top of every movie I had been seeing and logging this year.
Wow.
This A-S-S-H-O-L-E has a podcast? I have to check this out. Upon doing so, I was delighted to learn that our tastes aligned far more than I thought, and that he's not half as bad as the internet detractors would have you believe. Co-hosts Patches, Katie, and Dave Seven tastes converge with my own in a way that other film podcasts have not provided for me yet. Where have you guys been all my life? We've been doing this show for like 10 years. Catch up.
Well, now you actually have to tweet about it.
You all are delightful. And when the conversation occasionally brushes up against video games, TV, or a round table discussing a current event, I feel warm and complete. Sidebar for me, David. Thanks to Patches, with a little bit of Patches' help, I am moving into formal video game coverage soon. So that'll
– oh, no.
Yeah. We should always hear – not on Polygon – but in my own way.
He encouraged you.
Yeah, I
sent him in a
moonlight for Polygon.
You.
Yeah, no. I'm not taking your gigs. We should always hear opinions different from our own, especially viewpoints concisely and clearly articulated like you all. When one of you disagrees with another, you arrive briskly at the point instead of pirouetting around your differences. My only gripe with the podcast is that David Ehrlich sounds like he's recording every episode in a bathroom with an SHITTY Bluetooth mic from the early 2000s. I was shocked when I realized you four are not in the same room. And yet everyone but David actually does sound like they're together in person. David, please, God, get an FUCKING higher quality mic. I'm picturing the others in a studio huddled around one of those conference phones you see in every boardroom ever, listening to you interrupt them on speak. Microphone. Anywho, keep it up. A podcast that can swear and does not read a podcast that can swear and does not read ads is invaluable. We can swear. I don't know why you're spelling out all of the swear words.
To make you spell them, probably.
I suppose. I mean, we are here at your leisure. We will read what is on the page, but I'm telling you, we can say whatever you want. Also, where do I find episodes 1 through 120? P.S. Could you all settle an argument for me? Can films that are technically released in 2018 at, say, Venice, but don't make it into U.S. theaters or streaming well into 2019, still be eligible for a spot on year-end top 10 lists of 2019? The example that springs to mind is Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale. If so, what is the upper bound?
In fact, they don't belong on 2018 lists.
Okay. Example, Gaspar Noé's Climax premiered at Cannes, 5/18, and was in theaters, U.S. theaters, on March 19th. Thanks. Okay, let's go about this in reverse order. A lot of questions here. Patches, Katie, you already arrived at the right answer. A movie, at least for our metrics, the list that we make, it goes by the year of its U.S. theatrical release. So Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale would be eligible for this year, even though it did premiere in Cannes as What Is Hot May Never Pie mentioned last year. Premiered at Venice last year. Sorry, not Cannes. Dave, where do you find episodes 1 through 120?
Right now we haven't, we don't have a great place, but now that there's like multiple people asking for it, I have to boot up another feed. We are trying to make sure that everybody gets the podcast as fast as possible, which means keeping the feed under a certain size. And after you've been doing it for almost a decade, it was a big feed. So, go to fightinginthewarroom.com for the latest updates. Let's see. What day is it?
We start a new podcast where we upload new
by mid-October.
Files.
What is Hot May Never Pie?
A horrible solution.
What is Hot May Never Pie? May be surprised to learn that we have an entire other podcast that preceded Fighting in the War Room. And
we've been doing this for free for a very long time.
And those episodes are somewhere. Yeah, that's your other thing. The lack of ad reads. Yeah, we do this all for you, Damien. Don't know why, but we seem to enjoy it. I am recording on the same kind of microphone that everybody else has. I don't know why the sound is shitty. I have used to have the microphone because I thought
Dave
it was
going to chime in here and explain
kind
it to
of like
you
a
without
way.
Actually being
now
in
I am talking
room.
Directly into the microphone. My lips are all but touching it.
That's part of the problem.
No, it's not part of the problem. It's part of the solution. I don't know what the issue is, but we'll continue looking into it. I kind of take exception to the idea that my writing is smug. I completely own the fact that I can be smug as fuck on this podcast. I think it fits the general premise of the show, which is friends yelling at and over each other. But in my writing, I don't think I'm particularly smug. I think I just state my opinions emphatically, and I can understand how insufferable it would be if I were on Letterboxd and I kept populating to the top of the pages, but I don't think that makes the actual writing any more smug.
That Suicide Squad tweet is haunting
right
now.
Right, of course. Yeah, no, but I think the pans can sometimes drift in that direction because I'm only willing to offer so much respect at the feet of the Lion King. But I think in general that is more of a podcast and tweet thing, especially podcast. Anyway, I'm glad you're here. What is Hot May Never Pie? This review was very helpful. We answered a lot of questions. Thank you, both you and the Master Puppin for leaving us reviews. Please leave us reviews on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. We will, as is self-evident, read them aloud on the show. And they give us life because we don't take money. We just feed off of your words and acknowledgement.
A vampiric podcast.
Can't believe you read Bob Iger's book.
I did. I read a book this week. I read The Ride of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years of CEO of the Walt Disney Company, which, of course, would be written by Bob Iger. I read it for a bunch of reasons, but as somebody who's often on the side of talking about Disney properties and trying to, I don't know, convince my friends whether or not certain large media movements are good, I, of course, was very interested in finally knowing at least a perspective, if not the true story, on some of the large transformations that have happened to Disney in my time. As you guys, some of you might have. Has anybody read the book Disney Wars, the like preceding Michael Eisner sort of half gossip, half reported history book?
I've heard a lot of tales out of it, but I've never sat down to read that.
Is it a good read?
It's a big,
wait, there's
good
like
read.
A Disney corporate Hollywood Babylon out there.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
So definitely check out Disney Wars. But the whole idea that this tumultuous period at the end of Michael Eisner's reign that eventually gave way to Bob Iger was like a big Hollywood story for obvious reasons, especially since it, you know, also tracks the creation of DreamWorks and the breakdown between Eisner and Katzenberg. Anyway, lots of good Disney history. If you're interested in Disney Corps, then you probably read the book, and Bob Iger's book was the next one to like kind of look out for. He is supposedly actually going to step down in 2021, December 2021.
He was supposed to do that before, right? He was supposed to retire a few years ago.
Yes, he wasn't supposed to retire a few years ago and then renewed to sort of shepherd this Fox purchase, which in the book he says was a request of Rupert Murdoch that may or may not have been a way to ensure that Bob Iger would not run for president.
Do you...
What?
How much does he talk about him running for president in this book?
He admits that he thought about it and that he started...
in 2016?
No, he thought about running in 2020, right?
He thought for a 2020 run. Oh. This is like 2017, early 2017. He started talking to leaders in the Democratic Congress and in the Democratic Party and doing like crash course research things for himself about foreign policy and whatnot to try to feel out if he'd be competitive in those fields. But according to his own narrative, while he was doing this, you know, Rupert Murdoch called him to lunch, and Bob Iger assumed that it would be entirely about the presidency, but that was just the first question, and Bob Iger said no, and then Rupert Murdoch sort of indicated that he was willing to sell Fox, and that sort of turned Iger off a presidential run. But also because he's the CEO that successfully shepherded Pixar into Disney and obviously Marvel and now Fox, Murdoch wanted to make sure that Iger was still around to facilitate the successful swallowing of a gigantic company as he had previously. So the book, I would say, is separated into like thirds. The first third is Iger coming up through being president of ABC. And the whole thing is structured around like a loose idea that he's trying to give you ideas of how to manage people. But I don't know how relatable the CEO of Disney's problems are to other managers, but who knows? He has a lot of fun things to say in the middle part of the book, which is the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, and Star Wars, very specifically about learning through Pixar not to like fuck with a working machine. And he was so happy when he walked into Pixar to find this group of creatives who had this production structure in place and were willing to do like this Disney thing where they break it down and then build it back up. And they had all these other ideas, and you know, he saw like, you know, Brave and Finding Nemo and all these like rough cuts and storyboards, and was like, I can't believe like this company's willing to be bought, let's do it. And so he did it. But the difference between that and something like Marvel and Star Wars, and the parts of the book that I would think would be interesting to more people than people who are just interested in Disney history, is the Marvel chapter is very frank about you know, bringing everybody in and then having Marvel run on some sort of run into some issues with whether or not to put out like Black Panther and Captain Marvel. And at least in the book, Iger's story is that he calls Ike Perlmutter from Marvel and is like, cut it out with this shit. And the next day, like, Black Panther is greenlit. And then he also like rips Kevin Feige away from Marvel Studios. So a whole bunch of really interesting things there. But what's really interesting is the Star Wars chapter, which is a long outlining of how Bob Iger convinced George Lucas to sell off Lucasfilm and how Lucas basically like hated it and probably still hates it to this day. Like, all new Star Wars, George Lucas is not into it. He's into being recognized, but really early on, Bob Iger made him sign a, you know, non-disparagement clause so he can't say anything bad about the movies. But according to Iger, like, he sent, you know, J.J. Abrams over to meet with George Lucas before The Force Awakens, and George Lucas was expecting J.J. Abrams to pitch one of George's own storylines back to him, and he didn't, and has since apparently has been very soured on the process.
of Star Wars.
Does
that feel like a revelation based on what you expected Lucas to say?
Yes, actually, hearing that quote was in the book, or like George hated it, is what made me realize that the book was actually coming out, because that was what leaked as part of the reviews, and I was like, that's amazing, because the Disney narrative of Star Wars is so locked down, and Bob Iger talks about it a little bit in the book, but not really, but especially that first period where they're trying to come up with The Force Awakens, where they're George Lucas isn't happy. They just spent like billions of dollars. All the investors are like, you get one shot at this before we like fuck up your shit and don't trust you to do anything. And they have to come up with The Force Awakens. And they eventually do. So it's, you know, this story is a happy story. Bob Iger has lived a very successful life as CEO of the Disney company. But it is interesting to go back and remember how fraught that was. Because, like, from our side, like, production shut down. Like, Harrison Ford was injured. There's still this gray area of The Force Awakens productions. I don't think we'll ever know the true story that came about. So it's really interesting to hear that a lot of that was also, like, George Lucas pitching a fit. He didn't want to go to the premiere initially. It's just, like, all these, like, little stories where Bob Iger is like, oh.
What was Lucas's, what story do you think he wanted to hear? Like, in the years since, he's talked about the wills and all this kind of mystical force stuff that would have happened, but
apparently the narrative is, I'm paraphrasing the book, but George Lucas decided that he was interested in selling Lucasfilm, and he was, of course, really good friends with Steve Jobs, and so he invites Bob Iger to lunch, and he's like, I want the Pixar deal. And Bob Iger's like, Lucasfilm has no movies in production. You do not have a production structure. Like, you, George Lucas, have not directed the movie since the prequels. Like, I can't get you the Pixar deal. Lucasfilm is, like, not worth that. So George is kind of taken aback. And so it sounds like in the negotiations for Lucasfilm, George Lucas kept trying to be like, well, but I'll overwatch Star Wars, or but then I'll do a Star Wars movie. And Bob Iger had to back him off of that and be like, no, we're buying it for this IP, Star Wars. Like I said, no one really cares about Indiana Jones. But then, as a way to sort of make Lucas feel better right before the sale, they bought the treatments for the sequel trilogy off George Lucas and just didn't tell him they never planned to use it. They just did it to make him feel better. So when Abrams came in for that first meeting, that Lucas had already sold him three meetings. So three movies.
So
I love anyway, the idea that Disney of, like, has weird the money Hollywood to throw around like just to make George Lucas feel better.
Oh yeah, there's weird stories about outbidding Comcast for Fox, where it's just like, and we decided to go to $38 a share because we knew, you know, if we got a poll, it would go to like 40, so we just like shock them, and I'm like, that's like $5.4 billion. So eventually the book does become back. The last third of the book is the Fox sale and sort of like what Iger has learned overall about maturing creativity inside the companies that you devour. But it's, I don't know, it's a good read for if you like inside Hollywood stories, and especially to find like a corporate perspective on like what happened with Marvel and Star Wars is, yeah, I think, really interesting, especially as we start this sort of thing's getting locked down, and we're going to lose a lot of like the rumors that we lived through as history starts to solidify over like what this story is.
I guess that's my Bob big Iger question, kind of to wrap up, you know, Bob Iger. He did this interview with Maureen O'Dowd at New York Times, and you know, it became clear he's like, he really is like the nicest guy. He even when he's talking big corporate moves and strategy, he has a reputation for being the nicest guy, and he seems very nice. And I just wonder how that connects with being a true like media maven. And we talk a lot about how Disney is this pillar of culture, this monolith that's kind of taking over everything. And I don't know how that jives with Bob Iger's personality or ambition. Is he someone who in this book is like, I want to dominate culture. I want Disney to be everywhere. I want it to permeate every single walk of life. And I want everything that people watch and experience to be Disney. Does that, because that's how the company feels right now.
Sort of. I would say that the big point that I would characterize as a turning book for Bob Iger in the book is he is like just about to take over Disney, and his main issue is that the animation department is like gone to shit. And so he goes to Disneyland to like get a lay of the land before he goes to the shareholders. And he realizes that all of the IP, like none of it's from the past 10 years, and a lot of it is Pixar. So all of Disney's essentially broken. And in fixing Disney animation, he makes this great Pixar deal, which all of, you know, even Steve Jobs praised it as like the deal made Pixar better and Disney better at the same time. So once he does that, he's unlocked the key to surviving disruption, and he doesn't even know it yet, which is IP, which brings him to Marvel, which brings him to Lucasfilm. And then the acquisition of Fox, he's already thinking Disney Plus, and Fox is going to help them, you know, reach to a larger global market. So it's never really so much about, he doesn't come out and say like IP is the key, but he does often come out and say like, this year, these were the problems that the shareholders presented to me to find solutions for, and these were the solutions I presented. And then his last one's like Disney Plus, and the, you know, last part of the book's a big here we go, we're gonna survive the disruption,
we ain't done yet.
I feel like the fact that this book exists means he's still running for president. I haven't read it.
I don't know.
Do you feel like from reading it, he's not going to do it?
I think he's running.
So there is a thing.
A little bit late
like
this time around.
Part of Roseanne.
He could be that November surprise or whatever.
That November surprise I always talk about. Percussion. Strings. Winds.
Words. Yeah, you see her sitting there across the way. She don't got a lot to say, but there's something about her. Honk.
Yeah.
Honk, honk, honk. Honk, 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 honk,
honk, honk.
All right, I have a tragic...
So Patches...
I have a tragic story about the Goose Game.
Yeah, yeah, so you start with a tragic story about the Goose Game.
I bought the Goose Game last night.
Honk.
Mm-hmm.
Press Y to honk.
Honk.
And my Switch, which has to carry both Dragon Quest XI, the definitive edition, and Fire Emblem Three Houses.
I can't wait to have a kid.
Does not have enough room.
Honk.
For the Goose Game. And both of those games.
Oh, get a new SD card.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, you know, you can put some of these games in the system.
But someone who is, someone who works at a fancy video game website where they give out free SD cards like they're candy, talk to me about why the Goose Game's so great.
Wait, Patches, don't you also play more video games now that you have a kid?
Yeah.
No, I do not play more video
Patches
games now that I have
me
a
to
kid.
Suffer.
I thought the whole thing is that you don't leave the house, so you play video games. I swear
you should know best. Just because I don't leave the house doesn't mean I suddenly play more video games. What are
I
you talking about?
I watch more television. I just don't play video games.
I do not play more video games. I play the same amount of video games, but okay, less time spent playing them. Anyway, that's honk, honk, honk. Dave, what is Untitled Goose Game, and why is everyone on the internet talking about it? And I think Katie would like it, so you should really sell her on it.
But I have to buy Goose a game. Switch for it. This is okay. This is not this is
you can game. Play on one of your computers.
Okay.
So, Untitled Goose Game is by a producer called House House, and it is available on your Nintendo Switch, your OS, or your Windows through the Steam. You can just download that, play it on your computer. Super easy to play. There are simple actions because you play a goose in a small town that needs to be an asshole.
Yeah!
So, the town is split up into areas. That each area you will have a to-do list, and your to-do list are things like make the gardener or make the groundskeeper put on his sun hat or have a picnic by collecting like an apple and a radio and some sandwiches on a picnic blanket. And so you as a goose need to explore the environment and do cross off items on your to-do list, but you're really annoying these people and messing up their day. So it's a part puzzle game, part stealth game, where you are a goose, like, crawling around gardens, you're in a pub, you're in, like, a main street sort of area, honking at people. I honked at a little kid and made him hide in a telephone booth so I could steal his toy. And then I took his toy to a store on the main street, and put it on the toy shelf, and so he had to buy back his toy from the shopkeeper because I'm a little rascal goose. There's a button to interact with stuff with your beak. There's a button to make you honk. There's a button that you hold down to run, but you make like louder flappy noises, so you don't always want to be running. And then there's a button to make you kind of like put out your wings and flap them, which don't have a lot of purposes, but look really cool because this is all this like simple polygon looking game with a very simple interactive score that is like plunky piano when you're getting into trouble. There's no violence outside of like cartoonist situation, like dropping buckets on people's heads. They'll just push the goose out of whatever storefront it is. It is an adorable little puzzle game.
It sounds to me, from the way you're talking about it, that the goose is running.
The goose is running, yeah. Yeah, it's a little too late for 2020, but the goose is running.
The goose would have a really strong standing in a current Democratic polls if it was currently out.
It goes
goose game
Warren
is,
and then for now Biden and then the goose.
Hong Kong
Biden and the goose.
This time next week it could be Warren Goose 2020.
Honk 2020.
Goose game's been Patches, you could speak to this. Goose game's been taking the memes by storm.
Oh, absolutely.
Both gamers and non-gamers alike.
I mean, I think the antics combined with the silence of the actual game, which means that everyone can put like their own soundtrack over it, I've already seen both Succession and Righteous Gemstones versions of Goose Game footage. But what I was really thinking about is, you know, it has a meme factor, but it's just a really simple puzzle game. I used to play a lot of The Incredible Machine. Did you ever play The Incredible Machine when you were a kid, Dave? That was like a Sierra. It was a Sierra game where you were given the start and the finish of something, and you had to kind of plug in the pieces that they gave you to complete the puzzle.
I did play The Incredible Machine.
Yeah, you just finished the machine.
I had to Google it to see some screenshots.
And that's what Incredible Goose Game or Untitled Goose Game reminds me of. It's like, this is kind of obvious. The controls are super simple. You just need to figure out the pieces. What's the order of, do you get the keys from the gardener first, or do you set off the sprinkler? And throughout, I've been watching videos of people playing Goose Game. And Katie, this is why I think if you're going to make a foray into video games at all, maybe your kids would actually like watching Untitled Goose Game, not necessarily playing, because I don't think
they
play it well.
Watching me play Goose Game?
Watching you play Goose Game. Wow. I think would be a real bonding experience about like watching mom solve problems and kids getting to watch a goose honk.
You don't think they would want to just like grab the controls from me or the keyboard or whatever and play themselves?
But eventually they would, and then it would still be fun because then the goose would be running around like a mad goose honking everywhere. And that's
like that
own
luggage cart in the video from the airport we just saw. Yeah.
Actually, the goose can get its head stuck in like a bucket and swirl around and be really mad. So yes. Similar to that.
It's a really fun diversion thing. I think if you sit down and puzzle it out, you're thinking about like an hour and a half, 2 hours for like an average sort of goose experience once you get the hang of the goose game.
An average goose experience.
And then I think it's actually really well built too from a game design point of view because it climaxes in a really cool way that also makes you like revisit and then has like some new game plus options, which for you non-gamers out there, that means after you finish it, you get to kind of like replay, but with some new goals. Untitled Goose Game is like, I don't know, $16, $14.50, something like that, depending on where you grab it. And it's a worthy distraction in a world where all the other game, where it's like, I have to deal with Apex Legends Season 3 tomorrow. I'm going to go right back to killing people. But today I got to spend like 2 hours with the goose.
Honk.
And it's great. Honk.
So this week I have technology on my brain, and I want you all to help me because I don't know if it's good that I have technology on my brain, and I don't know if it's good for movie-going audience members to have technology on their brains when they go to the movies. But in these days, I think it's harder and harder to escape the unreality of film blockbuster realities. And that becomes a selling point for so many of these movies, the technological advancements that we get to experience that make something like an event film. It's inherently attached to all these experiences we have. And I think people are trying to become more fluent or think that they already are fluent in what makes a movie. And I want to know if that's good. And let me give some points of reference for what I'm mulling over here. This week, Universal is actually debuting footage from their new war movie, 1917, at New York Comic Con. I could not tell you why that was the right place to launch footage from a haunting World War I epic written
New
and directed
Comic-Con
by...
New York Comic Con has always been a weird, sorry to get you off.
They just need stuff. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. But this is an offsite too. It's very strange. But Sam Mendes is directing this script, and it was revealed this week, kind of a behind-the-scenes featurette with his cinematographer, Roger Deakins, the renowned DP, that this movie is going to be shot in a single take, or at least something that, you know, connects individual takes a la Rope and makes it look like a one take.
Probably more like Birdman.
No, we've skipped over Birdman. We're just going back to Rope.
I'm clinging to the good stuff here. They put out a trailer for this movie. It's a December release, so they have a lot of competition. And the kind of way that they're positioning this movie now, there was a big Vanity Fair story too you guys got to reveal that this movie was going to be in one shot. And I just thought that was so interesting that you guys revealed it as if it was big news that this movie was going to be filmed in one take or one continuous shot, and that they put out an entire kind of like trailer footage package as to promote this movie as a oneer, as if that really means something to the mainstream moviegoer. And perhaps it does. I don't know. And maybe that's what I'm here to debate, if we think we're at a point where that means something and what it means for general moviegoing or theatrical event films, which we're in the era where everything has to somehow be an event film to make the case for why it's in theaters.
I was just going to say, it sounds to me already like you're overthinking this just a little bit, because I feel like the fact that you are talking about it, that they were able to convince the roofs at Vanity Fair to make this an issue, it's a talking point. I don't think that it's a point of curiosity. It's a thing around the movie that people will feel compelled to see. It's advertising like anything else. It's you need to see Jennifer Lopez open her fur coat. You need to see Avatar because it's in 3D. I mean, there have been one-shot movies before, but that will be the thing that separates something like 1917 from, for example, the upcoming Midway, which is just, from all indications, a sort of run-of-the-mill
war movie. Which
is
directed by Roland Emmerich.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's just...
Right, but what I'm saying. That I'm surprised that a technological hook or a kind of below the line hook, if you will, is the actual hook. I mean, it's what Nolan has established.
Gemini Man as well.
What?
Isn't that the same story with Gemini Man?
Well,
about like how the technology there is.
I mean, yeah. So I'm thinking a lot about Gemini Man, a movie I've seen and happy to talk about a little bit. I want you all to see it so that we can discuss. But I got to see the movie in 120 frames per second. It's a huge technological endeavor for Ang Lee, who has employed this high frame rate technology before in Billy Lynn, which no one saw. And he's depressed.
I saw it in 120 frames per second.
Okay, you were one of like 100 people.
It was a total nightmare.
I mean, a lot of people got, you know, people remember the Hobbit coming out in high frame rate, and that was a headache and a half, and a lot of people did not care for Billy Lynn. I think Ang Lee, speaking to him a bit after my screening of Gemini Man, is depressed as hell that no one will be able to revisit that film in the way it was meant to be screened, and perhaps that he was just ahead of his time. No one watches movies that way. But Gemini Man is going to try again, that it's coming out in 3D. It has this completely digital Will Smith playing against real life Will Smith. It's not de-aging. It's kind of like Weta built a Na'vi, except it looks like Will Smith.
He did the mocap for it, right?
He did the mocap, but it's
so
not.
So how is it? Oh, so it's not, yeah, like so it's not Marvel de-aging. Movies. It's not taking his physically filmed face yet. Wait, how is that different from de-aging? Don't they have dots on their
face? It's different from de-aging because in de-aging, Samuel L. Jackson will wear like dots on his face while on set. And this is more like Sam Worthington becoming a Na'vi in Avatar.
So, like, Will Smith had, like, a camera rig on his face.
That's right. So Will Smith shot the movie on set as himself and then shot the entire movie again in, like, a box in Brooklyn.
This is a more comprehensive and complex process than what you see, for example, in The Irishman, which is another movie that people are going to be looking at through a technological lens. And I would imagine, although I haven't seen Gemini Man yet, that the illusion is a lot more convincing as a result of that extra work, even if the high frame rate probably distracts from that.
The opposite of that. The high frame rate helps those special effects.
I mean, it may sell the illusion of special effects, but it will probably pull the entire thing apart for me. Sort of, I imagine, but
Seen high frame rate
with The Irishman. It's incredibly distracting. The problem is that, in addition to the fact that all the faces look like they're the fucking dolls from Welcome to Marwen, Robert De Niro, when he's playing a like a 45-year-old, still has the body of a 75-year-old man. And so he's shuffling along and kicking people on the ground, and it looks like your grandpa.
I mean, you have the body of a 75-year-old man.
It matches my head.
I mean, okay, wait, Patches, you've seen Gemini Man, though.
Yeah, no, I've seen Gemini Man, and there is no way. I mean, I would say this is a very average thriller, paint by numbers plot. Will Smith being super duper quippy Will Smith mode. I mean, you will watch this either on an airplane or on cable, and it will be a good time. As 120 frames per second 3D experience, it is an event film. Truly, it is. I would never tell anyone to watch it any other way. I found every single scene to be interesting. Some successful, some less successful. But I never got headachey, or it was not like my Hobbit experience at all. It's pretty rapturous at times when, you know, they're using a Gatling gun and firing through a bodega and things are exploding in the air. It's strange to watch, a big motorcycle chase because high frame rate slows everything down. It like really inhibits, the physicality of Will Smith, like running through a courtyard with a machine gun or something. No one can move fast enough to make this camera work. So Ang Lee does a lot of cool tricks to try and kind of spice up the action. So you're constantly thinking about the technology throughout this movie, and certainly the hook and pitch to go see it has to be about technology. My big point here is, in this era where we're like, we go on and on about how practical effects are better than CG, that's why we all loved Fury Road, I see a lot of industry people kind of bemoan that and think about how, like, well, digital effects are always present too. Practical effects are good, but they're embellished by CG. Or, you know, when I'm thinking about the Wonder in 1917, I don't really understand if this kind of loose technological sales pitch is good for really understanding what a film does successfully. But in the case of Gemini Man, I do think having a great, I think it's to be appreciated by people who do understand movie technology. So I'm kind of like, I was really wanted your guys' opinions about how you've seen people react, or how you've seen these conversations play out about films that are kind of tied up in the technical conversation, whether the people talking about the technical really understand what's going on, or if the movies have kind of misled people.
Yeah, it does sound like the way you're framing it, like your feeling is that it's not the audience's problem. It's that Hollywood executives are misunderstanding what makes these movies work or not. And, you know, the issue is that and this has been true of film since the early days of silent cinema, that they're always putting the cart before the horse. They're always chaining this like asymptotal, you know, new reality and trying to get closer and closer to, you know, the myth of total cinema and all that. And, it only exposes the artifice the closer they get to that sort of, you know, imagined state of pure reality. And it seems like we'll never wrap our heads around the fact that you need that screen, that sort of liminal state between what's real and what's imagined for the movies to really take hold in our imaginations. But if this is something that gets butts out of the seats because it's an experience you can't replicate at home on Netflix, that's what's motivating it more than anything else. I don't know if they necessarily believe in the virtue of the technology, although Ang Lee sure does, for one reason or the other.
But how many people are even going to be able to see it in high frame rate? Like, I'm looking around at my local theaters, it's playing like one place 20 miles away in high frame rate.
Oh, really?
Very few. Yeah, I think it's only playing, there's only a handful of screens in the entire country.
Well, and I think
hold on. So they're going to,
I think a lot of the high frame rates is 60 frames, not 120.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there's, you're only able to see it in 120 in a very small
screen. Correct.
Like four in the world.
Paramount could not tell me how many screens it was playing in 120 frames, so that's how few. But every 3D screening will be in 60 frames.
Is it worth seeing in 60? Or
I think the answer is yes, because the 3D will be better. The whole idea of high frame rate is that the strobing of 3D is diminished. And then the effects of this digital Will Smith should become more fluid. And I mean, I certainly thought it looked really good in the high frame rate, but I don't have the comparison.
But you saw it in 120. So if I see it in 60, is it just going to be like The Hobbit?
I can't wait for you to tell me.
I only saw the first Hobbit in like in 60, and I did not like it at all. And then I never saw the others. And I don't have especially fond memories of it. I don't know.
These new facts make me mad.
Dave.
Go on.
Wait.
Imagine shooting a movie at 24 frames a second, and then the studio being like, yeah, but we'll do a 12 frame per second screening. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how Ang Lee feels.
I know, exactly.
But like, did Ang Lee expect all of these theaters around the country to retrofit like their systems to be able to play his one movie?
He's an artist. He doesn't give a shit. It's not his job.
I mean, that was James Cameron's strategy.
But yes, that's true.
Kind of worked.
Extinguished all the worst thing that James Cameron has ever done is convince all these independent theaters and all the chains as well to abandon their film projectors.
That's where all these things, I mean, the reason I think it's helpful to have this technologically front forward thing is because we're basically talking about mostly shitty blockbusters anyway. Like, we're not talking, like, The Irishman is the exception in de-aging technology at the moment in making a big deal about it for a prestige film. But usually it's like, why should I see Ant-Man 2 if I am not into seeing Ant-Man 2? And someone says, well, wouldn't it be fun to see a DH Michelle Pfeiffer? That's how I've heard it realistically play out. But I don't think it's negatively impacting the film experience, because it's just like 3D horror movies in the early 80s. Like, even if we aren't ready for the technology, there's going to be somebody who's going to use that technology to goose a genre in some sort of way. And that could give us the stepping stone that makes us have the real technology.
Say,
so it does.
Like, did you say goose? Goose?
Yeah.
Honk.
Goose.
Honk.
Honk. Honk. But yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, you have your ILM coming out of Star Wars and Weta coming out of Lord of the Rings with all this performance capture stuff that builds to Avatar and, you know, digital domains. Powder face for Benjamin Button suddenly becoming, you know, a standard for 360 motion capture that's now applied to television shows.
Yeah.
So it's like those sort of steps forward, I think, are fine. I think we're lucky when we get a Benjamin Button or maybe The Irishman, where the step forward in technology is also very notable. I always try to remember that No Country for Old Men was the first film that was fully digitally color graded.
Right.
So if you ever see a movie and you're
No Country. Oh Brother.
Oh Brother. I'm sorry. Yes. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So if you ever see, like, you know, a early 2000s movie where the color is like absolutely fucking amazing, that's, you know, old school film technology, and now there's a completely different art form on top of that that's been added to post-production that sort of swapped that out.
Yeah, I mean, I was, when Ad Astra came out, which is not all that long
ago. A week ago?
Yeah, I mean, James Gray was talking about how the monkey in Ad Astra, and this is actually probably not going to be a great example because people will stick up for the Planet of the Apes movies, but I mean, we're just talking about how the movies that prompt sort of these technological breakthroughs that use them as showcases for the technology are not ultimately their most refined uses. It's like, you know, I think a lot of this technology is best used in a movie down the line at some point where it's not the main focus. It's just a small element in the overall texture of something. So like the monkeys in Ad Astra, whatever they are, baboons, are only able to exist because of the technology that Weta pioneered when making the Planet of the Apes movies, which I know some people like.
Did Andy Serkis play the baboon in Ad Astra?
No. Oh. And it's funny because, like, James Gray thought that they would just be able to sort of like reskin some of the work that they'd already done, but because of the weightlessness of space, they actually had to start it from scratch. a total nightmare. But it's like that's one element in this big space movie, but it's only possible to integrate that element because another film completely dedicated its energy towards perfection. Because
you had a trilogy of Angry Monkey movies.
Right.
Yeah, so like those, I want to see Gemini Man more after you told us what Gemini Man was like after having seen it at 120 frames per second. Before, when I knew it was just the two Will Smiths movie, that wasn't enough for me. But I'm willing to see its experiment in 120 frames because especially, and I've said this in our group chat before, it's kind of insane that we still project movies at the frame rates that we do. Like the rest of our visual technology is far surpassing it in clarity and in frames per second. So,
are you supporting motion smoothing on televisions now?
No, I'm not supporting motion smoothing on televisions, but it is insane that if I want to buy a consumer level, GoPro camera, I have the capability of getting one that's capturing in 4K at 120 frames per second. And why is it when those things are developed to us, we don't see cinema that plays to that? It might be because we haven't developed the connecting technology to make that good. And hopefully that's what Ang Lee is working on. Someone should be working on it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I touched on when
he was working on something else, but
yeah, he's
going hard in this direction. To
of course,
he is.
I mean, he's been good tracking in this direction since The Life of Pi.
Oh, he wants to keep going, according to Ang Lee. His new goal is to create the most realistic fist fight movies have ever seen. That is what he said after Gemini Man was over.
I'm not knocking Life of Pi, even though I don't think it's a particularly good movie, but that was really just the start of this current phase of his career where he was prioritizing technology over sort of really anything else. And just chasing that dragon.
But he would not say that. He would say that he has three priorities. The digital will, which is an extension of the digital tiger, and the frame rate experiment to make it more realistic to your eyes. His whole thing is realism, not necessarily the technology, just achieving realism, which is interesting because he kind of couched his comments on that within ever since Crouching Tiger, I've wanted to make the most realistic action scenes.
So stupid. I mean,
so that's not what makes Crouching Tiger good at all.
Right. I mean, of course, and Crouching Tiger has its first action scene in Crouching Tiger is ballet, and the last action scene in Crouching Tiger is complete abstraction with them not even fighting up in the trees. It's so perverse to me that he has gone in this direction. Realism? Who the fuck wants realism in a movie? Why do we keep chasing this? It's been more than 100 years and we're still chasing our own tails.
Something weird happens when you have that much success. Like you've accomplished everything you want to do with fantasy and film. You're like, what can I do next? And then you try to get it.
But isn't that, I mean, this is kind of looping back to the beginning of my conversation, which is like the realism is actually a selling point to so many moviegoers. I don't know if you've met people like this, but I know a lot of people who will not entertain fantasy, will not entertain surrealism, will not entertain expressionism, and they want realism out of everything, and they don't feel like they like watching documentaries over most movies because they want something that is true, and they like Game of Thrones because it's not like any other fantasy because it's more realistic, and people love realism, and now it's a selling point. When you look at 1917, it's like the reason we're doing it in one take is because you'll feel us going from it's going to be in real time, it's going to be in real locations.
Like realism. People like the idea of realism. It's a very different thing. They like verisimilitude. They like the feeling of, oh, I'm a god. I'm watching the Titanic sink. I'm on it with Jack and Rose, my favorite real life characters. And the fact of the matter is that that is not the same thing as sort of VR experience of like, oh my god, you are there. I mean, what's so gripping and realistic about Titanic is not just the scale of the special effects, but you know, the whole illusion of it is what holds it together. It's not because you can, I don't know. It's not realism in the way that we tend to think of it. It's not realism in the way that people are thinking of it when they develop 120 frames per second.
Why aren't people watching Frederick Weissman films all the time?
Right. Exactly. No, exactly. Sure. If you like, and even those, of course, are not actually realism, but maybe the closest thing the documentary form can find to it. It's very silly.
And what 1917 is going to be is not, it's going to feel realistic. You're going to feel constantly watching the camera movements and looking at what happened. And hopefully it's not distracting the way that you can imagine something like that being, and you feel immersed in it, but you're also impressed by the skill of it. So it's another form of realism.
It's why elaborate long takes are seldom involving in that way. What they do is allow you to trace the trajectory of time. And the longer they go, the more you're able to sort of think about, wow, this is all in a contiguous motion from when X and Y happened an hour ago. And I know I can imagine where those characters are and what's changed and the scale of it all. I mean, like, it's more about time than it is about, the being transported into whatever it is that you're seeing, because you're not. I mean, as Katie just said, you're watching Birdman and all you're doing is thinking about how did the camera move that way and this way and where did they hide the cuts?
Yeah,
I don't know how it's going to be more immersive than Dunkirk. Like, it's not like the most favorite comparison. Right. I think they're going for a different thing, but Dunkirk felt like a stressful real time experience, even though it wasn't. And I don't know if being literal about it is.
But that's a great example because Dunkirk only feels so realistic in that way because of all the ways that it violates, you know, documentary reality.
Yeah,
and then it still has a technological hook, which is the actual exhibition of it. It's not about, hey, we're going to give you the most realistic version of this. We're going to give you the biggest, baddest 70mm version.
Oh, yeah. If you're talking about technological hooks, I mean, like, 3D is still around to that to some degree. Or it can be like, don't spoil the end game. Like, that's not really a technology hook, but it's some kind of like, here's my gimmick to get you to actually come to the theaters quickly.
Don't spoil the end game patches. But I mean, with 70mm and using that as a hook, that's getting people interested in how they're watching. So, like, that is just not something that people were talking about in the 20 years before Tarantino and Nolan started this kind of like celluloid push. People did not know how they were watching movies. And I'm still not sure people totally understand what 70mm really means to them. It doesn't mean, it means not Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I think that's exactly right. And that's all it really has to mean. For all intents and purposes.
I mean, do I like fully understand what I get out of seeing a movie on 70mm? Like, I think I do. I feel like the image is clearer and bigger and more interesting, but like, I don't know how much of that I can properly see with my eyes, but it does feel like something where you have to sit up and pay attention and see it in a theater, which, I don't know, as gimmicks go, that's not so bad.
I'm going to lob a weird thing here. Maybe it's a way of closing out. Patches, do you think FPS is a better battlefield to have than 70mm because it's part of other video conversations? Like, I know it's a huge gaming problem, keeping your FPS up on the... So, like, Katie's saying, or maybe you're all saying that, like, the average person sees 70mm is not as, like, an improved way of seeing something, but is not Netflix. Whereas I think if you start talking frame rates, some more lay people are going to have frames of reference.
No, I would say the opposite, oddly enough. Like, it feels like frame rate is not a conversation most people understand, and yet they watch football in high frame rate and they're currently pitching people on 4K. I think there was just this past weekend was one of the first 4K live streams of football. And then everyone who plays video games is constantly dealing not only in frame rate conversations, but about the most technological stuff. If you play video games, you learn about ray tracing and you learn about, just about frame rate and how that can be laggy. And there's just all these technological conversations that are inherent to playing video games that I'm surprised that, high frame rate is not a conversation that I think most people who go to the movies either want to have or even understand. Like, why does this movie look different? It's just bad to most people.
Yeah, in video games,
it's just different.
In video games, frame rate is more of a qualitative issue, right? It's like the higher the frame rate, the better the experience you're going to have.
That's the same argument that they're trying to make, though. Don't you want to see an action movie in 120 frames per second?
I
just watched Waterworld again last weekend, and I can tell you, I would love anything to make an action movie.
I think David's going to hate Gemini Man.
I think that it's more up in the air. I don't think we've all reached the consensus that more frames are better in movies. But in video games, if given the option to play a game in 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second, I will 100% of the time, like most people would, choose 60. I think it's not really an apples to apples.
The big difference is animation versus live action. Like, video games will always have the advantage of being fully animated, and I would love to watch a high frame rate fully animated movie by like Pixar or Blur or something like that, people who deal with video games, and I'd love to watch an entire movie like that. The problem with that Gemini Man runs into sometimes is that they have to deal with living objects. Like I said, it totally devalues Will Smith's athleticism. He can't run across a courtyard without being
living objects.
big objects. But yeah, it there's so many interesting, you know, and again, Gemini Man runs into the problem where if you're on like a movie set blowing up cars, it really feels like you're standing on the stage of an Indiana Jones stunt show or something. It's a very surreal quality. And I don't know if it's good or bad. You can just always tell.
Do you think, and the way you describe that makes me
worried,
concerned.
Yeah.
Do you think that the general public, hypothetically, if they are able to see the movie in this way, or even at 60 frames per second, is going to respond to this? Or is this kind of like a, I'm Patches, I liked Warcraft, I like when things are silly and big kind of thing?
Well, it's not that version of me, I would say. Mm. It is the like film tech junkie side of me. And again, it's not really a good or bad thing. It's just like I was really enamored by every scene because the technology is always in play and it's always changing how a normal version of that scene would play. And if you're really into what this illusion can do, then you will enjoy the hell out of this movie, I think. And if you don't give a shit and you just want to see a good story, then this may not be a good movie to see. I don't think anyone's going to see Gemini Man. That would be the big problem there.
You think it's going to bomb?
Yeah, I think it's going
to
bomb.
Are fewer people going to see it than like Ad Astra?
No, it's tracking to open to like $24-25 million opening weekend.
So slightly more than Ad Astra.
Yeah, I mean it's not great, but I think that a movie like Gemini Man is probably going to make most of its money
China
internationally anyway.
Yeah. What's the 120 frame per second adoption internationally?
If we have tickled the technological side of your brain with this conversation, I would recommend seeing Gemini Man in as high a frame rate as you possibly can.
Yes.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. Maybe with our minds blown by 120 frames per second of Gemini Man. Maybe not. We'll see. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
No, we need to talk about the Joker.
Yeah, we'll be back for that.
We'll talk about the Joker. Twisted. I'm Matt Patches. I'm a senior editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. You can listen to episodes. You can share them with your pals or your fellow Jokers. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
Hey Patches, can you do me a favor? When you introduce me, can you introduce me as Joker?
And here's Joker.
Oh, hi. I'm the Joker.
I hate this so much.
Is that how he talks? Does he talk in 30 Rock baby voice?
I'm Joker. I'm a very sexy baby.
I'm a very sexy baby. Joker baby.
I like chaos. I don't know. I honestly can't remember. That was so many movies ago. I'm David Ehrlich. I am not the Joker. I don't think yet. You can find me I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can read my review of Joker, I guess. We'll talk about that next week on IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review, babies.
And I'm Dave with a 7. You can follow me on Twitter at DS7E. I also do a podcast called The Storm. We are about to finish up our first season of Lost Rewatch with Exodus Parts 1, 2, and 3 episode. It's going to be at least over 2 hours long, I guarantee it, with at least one guest. And if we get two guests, then absolutely it'll be the best episode of the podcast. Check it out at Storm Podcasts, or just look for the Storm Lost Rewatch podcast in your podcast app. You can also go to stormpodcastlive.com if you want to come see me in Boulder, Colorado, November 21st, along with Joanna Robinson and Neil Miller. It'll be fun. stormpodcastlive.com.
I can't believe you would say it's better than the episodes of Patches and I were on.
I know. I was going to chime in and be offended, but I didn't want to cut them off.
I'm offended.
Katie did have two guests, and then Patches did do one of our most loved guest interviews on the subject of parenthood on the island. So I'm more doing as a way to sell you guys that is how good our finale episode is going to be.
Patches, when they end this rewatch series, we're going to be parents of like kindergartners, so we can really weigh in on parenthood by then.
Dear God. The TV show?
Yes, exactly. We'll make them pivot to a Parenthood series. Hello, I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on the Little Gold Men podcast, where this week we're talking about The Irishman and Joker and Judy and all of the Oscar buzz you can't keep track of. We keep track of it for you. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRach. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can tweet at us about a lot of things. And this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of the Joker and the Wrinkle the Crown documentary coming out in the same week, what genre of movie needs a clown?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
A pom pom, then the gong is a ba bum ba bum ba bum. Now I'm done. We're done.